New California bill educating K-12 school children on the attempted genocide of Native Americans goes into effect January 1st. The Oregonian reports that Governor Gavin Newsom signed the bill in September. The curriculum will educate students on the California Native tribes who endured violence, oppression, and atrocities during the Spanish colonial period and the Gold Rush. Supporters say it also teaches about the resiliency of Native people. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 17th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, and Judith Ruiz Branch. The producer is myself, Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. As Israeli operations expand in Lebanon, the human toll resembles Gaza's. Thinking crazy thoughts in Israel. And the situation in Haiti is dire. First, the Israeli operations in Lebanon. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the other day, quote, "We will do to Lebanon what we did to Gaza." Stories coming out of southern Lebanon since the Israeli incursion suggest massive and growing human suffering. Here are some sample stories. First, the UN World Food Program expressed, quote, "extraordinary concern for Lebanon's ability to continue to feed itself because of the impact of the fighting on food production. More than 7 square miles of cropland has been burned over the past year, most of it in the last few weeks, in fires started by explosions." Matthew Hollingworth, the agency's representative in Lebanon, told reporters that more than 45 square miles of some of the most productive farmland has been abandoned because of the conflict, threatening harvests of such crops as olives, citrus fruits, and bananas. Next, as of about 10 days ago, Lebanon's health ministry reported about 2,000 deaths, including 127 children, since the Israeli invasion began September 30th. 70 towns have been ordered to evacuate. Israel's forces are moving north, well beyond the southern area marked by a 2006 UN buffer zone. An estimated 1.2 million people have been displaced, nearly a quarter of Lebanon's population. A later report is that the Israeli Defense Forces have ordered the UNIFIL, the United Nations force in Lebanon, which administers the buffer zone, to leave the area on the argument that Hezbollah's forces have been deployed there. The World Health Organization expressed concern over rising Israeli attacks on healthcare workers and facilities in Lebanon. Since Israel launched its cross-border assault, such attacks have killed 65 health workers and injured 40 others. Ian Clark, A World Health Organization official in Lebanon told reporters on a video call that 5 hospitals are no longer functioning due to damage and 4 others are partially evacuating as a result of Israel's operations, warning, he said, that the attacks are further weakening a health system. By the way, the healthcare system in Gaza has also suffered immensely, as I think we all know. A UN human rights inquiry has just determined that, quote, Israel has perpetrated a concerted policy to destroy Gaza's healthcare system, making its operations actually a war crime. The same report also found that Hamas has, quote, committed the war crimes of torture, inhuman or cruel treatment by taking Israeli and foreign hostages and holding them captive, unquote. Israel's long-term aim in Lebanon is open to question. When Netanyahu appealed recently to Lebanese to rise up against Hezbollah to save their country, he may have had something more sinister in mind. He said, quote, you have an opportunity to save Lebanon before it falls into the abyss of a long war that will lead to destruction and suffering like we see in Gaza, unquote. But behind the scenes in Israel, voices are rising, and not just on the far right, to make the cleared area permanently free of Lebanese, a buffer zone that would amount to forced displacement, which is contrary to international law. That idea squares with what Israel seems to have in mind in northern Gaza, where it has issued orders for Palestinians to clear the entire area. According to the UN, that would amount to about 300,000 to 500,000 people. The orders are a death threat for tens of thousands of residents who have been constantly pushed around and subject to bombing in so-called safe zones. As a retired Israeli Defense Forces general says, quote, the entire northern territory will become military territory, meaning it will be a free fire zone in which anyone staying will be presumed to be a terrorist. No food or other aid will be allowed in. Israeli authorities acknowledge that no plan exists for the return of the Palestinian population to their homes. This sounds very much like ethnic cleansing. Thinking crazy thoughts in Israel. Dennis Ross, a longtime U.S. diplomat and one-time special envoy to the Middle East, made the following statement recently. From a U.S. standpoint, while it looks like we are in a region characterized by conflict, we are also seeing the most important Iranian proxy degraded. Opportunity to recreate Lebanon. If we can stop this war, this provides an opportunity to reshape the Middle East. Imagine that. What's ominous about those words is that they echo what some prominent political figures and commentators in Israel are saying, namely, that now is the time for Israel, once and for all, to rid the world of Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Iranian threat. For example, Ben-Dror Yemini, an independent journalist, writes, quote, we are reaching the moment of decision because no strike on Hamas or Hezbollah will help without striking Iran, the head of the snake. Now it is Israel's turn to turn crazy, unquote. In a world hostile to Israel, where, he says, the axis of evil has widespread support, Israel must act on its own and the world's best interest by taking out Iran's nuclear facilities. How that will actually make Israel, the Middle East, or anywhere else more secure isn't argued. Go crazy indeed. The U.S. is actually making Netanyahu's decision on a military response to Iran easier by sending an advanced missile defense system to Israel to be operated by U.S. troops. That deployment may give Israel cover for its anticipated retaliation. It also marks a critical step toward direct U.S. involvement on Israel's side, with the added possibility of U.S. casualties should Iran further retaliate. CNN reports that the U.S. and Israel have been in consultation about Israel's next step. Biden is said to have urged a proportional Israeli attack, which presumably means asking that it not attack Iran's oil fields or nuclear facilities. Netanyahu has reportedly assured Biden that Israel will only hit military targets in Iran. How to interpret this? Instead of trying to end this escalating tit-for-tat situation, the leader of the world's most powerful nation is contributing, albeit reluctantly, to more warfare, concerned about an election and oil prices, but apparently not about civilian lives, the Israeli government's indifference to American advice, or the prospect of a regional war. Biden may say all kinds of nasty things about Netanyahu. According to Bob Woodward's new book, Biden calls the Israeli leader a, well, I can't repeat it on air, but a bad guy. But the president time and again has allowed Bibi to act contrary to U.S. wishes and contrary to international law. The situation in Haiti is dire. Despite the presence of a Kenyan international peacekeeping force, gangs still control most of the capital, Port-au-Prince, and key access points to other cities. The force is outmanned by the gangs, which, as before, rule by violence in neighborhoods. An on-the-scene journalist reports the following: more than 700,000 people who fled their homes during a wave of violence over the past year and a half are still unable to return. Half the country's population, roughly 5.4 million people, struggles to eat every day, and at least 6,000 people living in squalid camps are facing starvation, according to an analysis released recently by a group of global experts. In other news, Taiwan's president keeps taunting the People's Republic of China. At a party to celebrate Taiwan's 113th birthday, President Lai Ching-te said the Republic of China on Taiwan cannot consider the People's Republic the motherland. After all, said Lai, the People's Republic of China has only celebrated its 75th birthday. Therefore, in terms of age, it is definitely impossible for the People's Republic of China to be the motherland of the people of the Republic of China. On the contrary, he added, the Republic of China on Taiwan may actually be the motherland of the people over 75 years old on the mainland. As he has said on previous occasions, President Lai referred to Taiwan's sovereignty, contrary to Beijing's view that Taiwan belongs to China. Predictably, soon after Lai's speech, China began new military exercises in and around the Taiwan Strait. Its Eastern Command announced that the drill, quote, serves as a stern warning to the separatist acts of Taiwan independence forces. It is a legitimate and necessary operation for safeguarding state sovereignty and national unity, unquote. Taiwan called the drill a provocation, but China promised still more drills. Elon Musk decides to pay fines in Brazil. Some weeks ago, I reported that Elon Musk had defied Brazil's Supreme Court by failing to comply with a law that requires businesses, in this case X, to name a local representative. The court said he had to pay millions of dollars in fines, and Musk rejected that. What the dispute was really all about was the court's finding that X, which has 22 million viewers in Brazil, was disseminating far-right misinformation and anti-democratic content. Now Musk has about-faced and agreed to the ruling and to paying the hefty fine. Gerson Camarati, a prominent Brazilian political commentator, told the news channel Globo News, quote, "This was about non-compliance with judicial decisions. It's Brazilian democracy that gains with this. The most interesting thing," he said, "is that Brazil didn't grind to a halt because of the ban on X. Nobody in Brazil died because of the absence of X," he said. Camarati lamented how Musk's social media platform had become, quote, "the network of hatred." The World Bank assesses China's economic slowdown. The World Bank has joined numerous others in assessing what China's economic slowdown means for the rest of Asia. As reported by Bloomberg, quote, "China's expansion is set to drop to 4.3% next year from an estimated 4.8% growth in 2024. As a result, growth in East Asia and the Pacific, which includes countries like Indonesia, Australia, and Korea, will slow to 4.4% in 2025 from about 4.8% this year. The bank is not convinced that the Chinese government's various monetary stimuli will significantly jumpstart the economy. China needs structural reform," says the bank. Made in China, Trump's Bibles. Donald Trump and J.D. Vance have extolled the virtues of bringing manufacturing back to the USA, especially from China. And since China is national security threat number one, we would expect that the former president would want to avoid doing business with those communists. But of course, exceptions are made when profit is possible. According to a report from the Associated Press, the Bibles, which retail for $59.99, are being produced for less than $3 each by a printing company in Hangzhou, China. Import and export shipping records, analyzed by the Associated Press, identified three separate shipments of Bibles with an estimated value of $342,000, suggesting $7 million in revenue off of this grift. Trump produced the Bibles in partnership with Greenwood and offers special editions, including a signed copy that retails for $1,000 and a The Day God Intervened edition commemorating the assassination attempt against Trump in July. The website where the Bibles are sold claims no affiliation with Trump's presidential campaign, only the use of his name, likeness, and image under paid license. Trump has so far earned at least $300,000 from this venture. I wonder how Trump's sneakers, high top and low top, golf items, pieces of his assassination time suit, watches, coins, and cologne, have I missed anything, are doing, and how many of those items are also made in China. Finally, some news in brief. First, Canada has expelled six Indian diplomats over the killing of a Sikh separatist leader last year. Both India's embassy and its intelligence service have been credibly linked to the assassination. Next, U.S. intelligence estimates total Russian war casualties at 615,000 in Ukraine since the war began, 115,000 dead, 500,000 wounded. Ukraine's casualties are estimated at 57,500 dead and about 250,000 wounded. The figures reflect the war's character, attrition, a meat grinder. Next, the Wall Street Journal reports on a Chinese hacking group that penetrated the networks of several large U.S.-based internet service providers, including Verizon and AT&T, and may have gained access to systems used for court-authorized wiretaps of communications networks. The purpose of the hacking may have been to discover the Chinese targets of surveillance efforts. Whether the hackers succeeded at acquiring a list of such targets isn't certain. It is also not clear, says the Washington Post, whether the subjects of the surveillance at issue were targeted in domestic criminal investigations or in national security cases, such as espionage, terrorism, or cybersecurity. And finally, tensions are rising again between the two Koreas. Each side charges the other with provocations, the North citing U.S.-South Korean joint military exercises and South Korean drone intrusions, the South citing trash-filled balloons sent into its territory, and threats to blow up east and west roads that connect the two countries. In the background is North Korea's announced aim to enforce separation between the two Koreas, ending hopes for eventual reunification. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Eliza Yurkov. Much is made in this country about the U.S. Constitution. Politicians at various levels of government swear to uphold or defend the Constitution when they take office. It is often considered a bulwark of democracy. But author and journalist Dan Lazar doesn't share that view. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
The U.S. Constitution, you've been studying that. I wonder how much inspiration do you get from the work of Charles Beard, if any at all?
I don't like Beard.
And why is that?
I can't stand Beard. I think he's an economic reductionist. He reduces,
not seeing the whole picture, okay.
He reduces the whole thing to a very simple-minded concept of the profit drive. And, you know, profits are important, certainly, but you can't reduce it to something as simple as that. The founding was a very complex event. It's very complicated and requires a lot of thought and analysis to understand.
Although some would say he's not as much of an economic determinist as some people think, but maybe that's another subject. What in your mind is wrong with the U.S. Constitution? Do you oppose it because it kind of holds back progress, the real progress you'd like to see?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are many things wrong about it. It's not very democratic. It essentially allows minorities, well-placed minorities, to tyrannize the democratic majority. But the most important thing that's bad is the amending clause, which, as you know from your high school days, says that any amendment must be approved by 2/3 of each house plus 3/4 of the states. And the 3/4 requirement means that 13 states can block any amendment, and that 13 states can account for as little as 4.4% of the U.S. population. So as a result, the document in this day and age is essentially unchangeable, which means that we are permanently locked into an 18th century plan of government, which is extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. It'll take you a while to wrap your mind around that concept. We're a modern society. You and I are talking via the internet, and yet we are governed by a plan of government that dates from the age of slavery, powdered wigs, silk knee breeches, and the quill pen.
But people will defend the Constitution, saying that this protects our democracy, although I suspect they're really thinking of the Bill of Rights part more than the Articles.
Yes, I mean, the Constitution has come down to us as a kind of a charter of liberties. People view it the way Christians viewed the Bible in the Middle Ages. It's the good book.
And people even take an oath to protect the Constitution.
Right. But if you ever read the Bible, you'll know that it's fascinating, but a good book, it ain't. And if you ever read the Constitution, rather than accepting it on faith, you'll see that it's filled with all kinds of totally perplexing and totally undemocratic provisions. I mean, a Senate based on equal state representation, which means that Wyoming, lily white Wyoming, has the same number of votes as minority majority California, which has 68 times its population.
And is it true that the Senate is the only institution in the Constitution that can't be abolished?
Yeah, Article 5 is the amending clause, and Article 5 ends with a clause saying that no state shall be deprived of its equal representation in the Senate without its consent, meaning that if you want to change equal representation, you need the consent of all 50 states, which is impossible. And so therefore, it's unchangeable.
Is that a throwback to the Roman Republic?
Well, the whole thing is it's a throwback to the Roman Republic. It's a throwback to the Vatican and the College of Cardinals. It's a throwback to late medieval republics, you know, which were ruled by very complicated, you know, arrangements in which there was, you know, voting figured, but voting was, you know, was complicated, roundabout, staggered, etc. So the U.S. Constitution is much closer to those political formations than it is to a modern democracy.
So Donald Trump has made statements suggesting he would shred the Constitution, and people are fearful of that. What do you make of his comments?
The thing is that the Constitution has given us Trump. That's the important thing. I mean, liberals say, you know, liberals, you know, uphold the Constitution against Trump. But the reality is quite the opposite. The Constitution has given us Trump. I mean, first of all, it gave us an all-powerful presidency, but it also gave us a system of checks and balances, which has completely broken down, leading to a utter paralysis on Capitol Hill and a very dangerous buildup of political tensions, which is, you know, unresolvable. It also gave us the Electoral College, which in 2016 gave us Donald Trump, despite the fact that he lost by 2.9 million popular votes. In 2020, it nearly gave us Donald Trump because the electoral machinery as outlined in the 12th Amendment is fiendishly complicated and can be easily hijacked, as Trump nearly succeeded in doing. So you know, the Constitution is not the antidote to Trump. The Constitution is the facilitator of Trump.
What would you like to see happen to the Constitution?
First of all, number one, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of books recently calling the U.S. Constitution into question. It was formerly the Holy of Holies, but now suddenly, over the last 12 months, it seems that every law professor in the country, you know, wants to write a book taking a knock at the Constitution. And the traditional remedy is a constitutional convention. But the trouble with the constitutional convention is that, according to Article 5, whatever it comes up with must be approved by 3/4 of the states as well, which means that 13 states can veto whatever it recommends. So we're in the same old bind, where 4.4% of the population can essentially veto the other 95.6. What I call for is something very different. I call for a constituent assembly, such as they had in Paris in 1789. A constituent assembly would be called not under Article 5, but under the preamble. The preamble, as you know, is we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, et cetera, do ordain and establish this Constitution. And what it doesn't say, but what it plainly implies, is that we the people can also overthrow the existing Constitution, which was the Articles of Confederation, which were still in effect when the Constitution was drafted and ratified, and which the Constitution overthrew contrary to the rules of the Articles, because the Articles said that that they could only be changed with the unanimous approval of all 13 states, and the Constitution said, no, this Constitution will go into effect when approved by just 9. Anyway, a constituent assembly is an assembly of the constitutional power, we the people, coming together not as residents of the various states, but simply as the people as a whole, voting democratically on a basis of strict majoritarianism on whether to revise the existing Constitution or whether to toss it out and start all over. But democratic majoritarianism means that whether you like or dislike the Second Amendment, for example, you put it up for a majority vote. You know, you don't repeal it via the two-thirds, three-fourths process. You repeal it via the 51% process. So you say, you know, say, I have a resolution. I offer a resolution to remove the Second Amendment. All in favor say aye. And if 51% votes aye, out it goes.
Wouldn't the fear there be that people could do that for civil rights legislation? And
absolutely, yes. That is a terrifying prospect. But what's even more terrifying is the status quo. I mean, you're like, you know, you're standing on the, you're standing on a window ledge in a building that's on fire. You've got flames behind you and several stories of open space in front of you. So what do you do? You know, and one, you know, the one is you'll be burned to a crisp, and the other, you have at least a fighting chance of making it out alive. But the point is I think a democratic process, a constituent assembly would be a democratic process, and I am quite confident it would lead to a democratic constitution.
So would this be via electronic media so everyone could participate?
No, would it be
delegates sent to?
Delegates. You have a national election. You have voting by list. You know what that means? It means, in other words, you have parties. Offer themselves the vote, and seats in the assembly are allocated according to each party's share of the vote as closely as you can do it. And so you have elections, and you have a socialist party and a conservative party and a liberal party and a feminist party and a green party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they are given seats, and their job is to essentially govern the country in the short term and to draft the Constitution.
That would upset the whole foreign policy establishment and every other establishment.
It's a revolution, but it's a democratic revolution. And I'm also quite confident it would be a socialist revolution as well, because by that point, the social tensions have reached the point that they would express themselves in a revolutionary way. The current constitution is of, by, and for the rich. It allows the interests of the working class to be ground into dust. And the only force capable...
Although you could still pass legislation in favor of working class people.
No, you can't.
You can't.
You can't.
The right to organize, for example.
In reality, you can't. In reality, anything that passes, that makes it through the meat grinder on Capitol Hill is going to be in favor of the rich because they control Congress.
But it seems like there's legislation that has been passed that protects consumers and workers and the environment and all that.
Only by accident. No, I mean, I'm serious. I mean, yeah, yes. I mean, not everything that comes out of Congress is bad. Some progressive legislation has been passed. I'd be foolish to deny that. But the fact is that in general, such progressive acts are surrounded by, you know, are outweighed by reactionary legislation. And there's no doubt that the political edifice that has arisen over the decades radically favors the rich, the capitalist class, the ruling class.
And anything else you want to add to what you said?
No, I mean, I think America is in America is reached a dead end. And I think that, you know, and it's funny, I wrote my book, The Frozen Republic, in 1996. And I actually got laughed at. And on one show, some guy laughed at me. And when I said that America had reached a dead end, they said, oh, that's crazy. That's an exaggeration. That's silly. You're obviously a nut. You obviously are a marginal character who is embittered by his own marginalization, et cetera.
Rather than a visionary.
Right. But 25 years later, it is completely different. I mean, what I'm saying has become mainstream. People realize that America is in serious trouble.
And although they don't pinpoint the Constitution as
well. Well, but there's actually, I mean, the current New Yorker magazine, which is as mainstream as you get, has an article entitled Torch the Constitution, a review of a new book by Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the dean of the Berkeley Law School. And that's as establishment as you get as well. So I'm not saying that the establishment has gone socialist on us, but I'm saying that even people in these high places recognize that the country's at an impasse.
That's author and journalist Dan Lazar speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Eliza Yurkov. Thanks for being here.
Listening to KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting